Okay, there was two things I wanted to address. Kim Oldfield asked a question last night, so I went and ran some numbers. He wanted to know what people use, because we did ask you, and it's on your badges. So, firstly, this is one of the questions of life, I guess, VI versus Emacs. All right. Now, we had a couple of options there, and I've summarized it down. We actually had a request for one to add. Are our two BB Edit people here? Yeah? All right, there's one guy who wanted sex. I can't help you there. But, okay, so just summing the numbers of the people who are here. Emacs, 40. VI and derivatives, 220. Okay? The numbers I've spoken, but wait, there's more. This is the second one I wanted to give to you guys. Distribution. Who chose Xbox Linux? And have you got a booting? Did you modify the bus? Anyway, macOS 3. Sun Linux. Hans, I think you got all the Sun guys in tow. 7. SUSE 8. FreeBSD 11. Mandrake, while you're still there, 19. And then we've got two big ones, Red Hat and Debian. It's close.
It's not that close.
Red Hat, 135. Debian, 168. Yeah. But that didn't include all of the other derivatives of Gen 2 and things like that. It was just straight that one because I was pressed for time. Anyway, so having said that Debian...
So it really isn't that close.
No, well, okay, there's you know, 30 different. Having said that, we should probably introduce the guy who knows a little bit about Debian. Bidal Garbi is the Debian project leader, has been now for 11 months? No, 10 months?
Well, no, it takes 9 weeks to get elected, so...
Seems to take forever. So, without any further ado, please make him feel welcome, Bidal Garbi.
Is that on? Can you hear me in the back? Somebody wave. You are awake? Good. I had the opportunity last night to learn just what the value is of waiting until the last minute to get your presentation for one of these finished up. Because I was going to be sitting up last night making sure that this was okay for this morning, I didn't drink. And since I was the guy driving and got to blow in the tube both coming and going around the bay, what I'd like to talk to you about this morning is just sort of a my perspective on the Debian project, how it works, why it's interesting, what makes it different from other Linux distributions. I presume, based on the numbers that James just quoted, that a fair number of you already have some inkling of the answers to those sorts of questions. Out of curiosity, of those of you who got up this morning, how many of you run Debian on one or more of the systems that you use? You know, I said yesterday, I'll say it again, I think that's a higher percentage than at DebConf 2. It is really marvelous to come down here and have such a warm reception in that regard. And out of curiosity, how many of you are Debian developers here this morning? Great. How many of you aren't but are thinking about it maybe? Yeah, that's a really mind-boggling number. Actually, I think that for those of you, some of what I'll be trying to talk about this morning is perhaps even more germane than for anybody else, but of course I'm going to try and make this contain some items of interest for everybody. Because what I'm really going to try and do this morning is sort of give you a flavor for what Debian's about. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the project. I'm going to talk a little bit about some other things. I've been asked, though, what the title is all about. Maybe this herding cats thing isn't as well known a gag down here as it is up in the U.S., but there have even been, I forget which company it was, it was EDS maybe, one of the IT companies ran a television commercial showing these guys, you know, in the cowboy outfits herding, you know, domestic house pet cats across the prairies. And when we were in Debian, or in Toronto for DebConf 2, around the time of the dinner, someone walked up to me and said, "So, now that you've been DPL for a few months and are the chief cat herder, how's it been?" And without really thinking too hard, I looked them straight back in the eye and I said, "Well, the nice thing about this particular set of cats is that they're mostly self-herding." And I don't really know why, but that seems to have sort of been picked up and quoted in odd places since. So that's really what the the basis of the title is all about. Debian is interesting because it's a completely volunteer organization. And one of the interesting attributes of volunteer organizations is you really can't tell anyone what to do. You can suggest things, you can set directions, you can try to point people to things they haven't thought about. But by definition, when people are volunteering their time, they're going to work on the things that they want to work on, the things that make them feel better at the end of the experience than when they started. Sometimes those can be really icky, ugly things if there's a sense of accomplishment that comes from it. But one of the things you realize very quickly when you're dealing with large volunteer organizations, I suppose even with small ones, but all of these things get magnified when the organization gets big, is that leadership works and management doesn't. So I was reading Debian Weekly News yesterday morning, and I tripped over this item, and I thought it was worth quoting. Someone pointed out that in some of the photos from the Hubble Space Telescope, in particular this one that I cut a little excerpt out of the corner of, that there's clear evidence that, you know, the Debian swirl is out there. And given how far away they think that galaxy is and how much time it's taken the light to get here, it seems pretty clear that Debian's been in existence longer than humanity. I don't know about that, but it certainly seems to me like it's been going on for the better part of my existence, even though it's only since about 1995 that I've been involved. Anyway, I thought that was sort of amusing and timely. And then this morning in my email, someone pointed out that these are on clearance sale in the U.S. right now. Of course, you have to go to shopping.msn.com, which gives me hives. But, you know, for the rousing sum of $19.99 US plus shipping and handling, you could have yourself a Penguin drink shaker. To get back to Debian things. So what I really want to do is sort of give you an overview of the Debian project. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got involved with Debian, because that gives me the opportunity to shamelessly stick in a couple of satellite pictures, and I have to do that. And I want to talk sort of about how Debian works, how the project's organizational and relationship structure has evolved over time, and a little bit about how it works today. And if nothing else, what I'd love to do by the end of the talk this morning is give you sort of a sense for this thing I'm describing as the Debian community. I've come to realize over the last year that as the project's grown, it's not really like a big dysfunctional family anymore, which was the way I felt about it when I first got involved. The project is big enough now to have subgroups and almost subcultures in different parts of the project, and it really smells to me a whole lot more like a village or something with, you know, a growing town with sprawling suburbs, and we're starting to put mass transit in to get to the people out in the hinterlands, and hopefully by the time we're done this morning, you'll have a better sense for what that community is all about and how it works. Just to be absolutely clear, this is not an introduction to using Debian. In fact, I'm going to talk precious little about using Debian. Go poke around, look at the website, ask questions afterwards if you'd like, but in general, if you aren't already using it, just give it a try. So what is Debian? Well, this is sort of the definition of Debian in some sense. I picked up this quote from a talk that Vikert Ackerman gave. I don't know where it originated, but I like it. The Debian Project is an association of individuals who've made common cause to create a free operating system. And more specifically, you know, Debian is probably best known here for being a significant GNU Linux distribution, but the project has actually grown to be something a little bit bigger than that. It is a huge project by almost any measure that you put on it, and I'll show you some statistics in a minute. But it runs on more architectures than, you know, any other free operating system I'm aware of, much less Linux distribution. It's a completely open volunteer organization. Everybody that works on Debian works on it because they want to. Some of us are lucky enough to have gotten to the point where at least part of what we do is being paid for by somebody, or we're being allowed to work on it as part of our day jobs or something like that. But people come to Debian first because it's a place that they can do things they want to do, and then if they're lucky, they get paid for it, as opposed to some commercial distributions where, you know, people get excited about the opportunity to have a job and make money first and sort of come to the philosophy and the other motivators later. It's very international. I'll show you a plot in a minute of where Debian developers are distributed around the world. I've had the opportunity to realize in some of my recent travels and talks that the use of Debian is much broader even than the distribution of developers. There are countries I've been to where Debian is really quite popular and there are no Debian developers at all, like Mexico. We're looking forward to seeing one of the couple of people that are in the new maintainer queue from Mexico now get through the process. But it's caused me to realize that this is just a hugely broadly geographically distributed activity. And there's something really sort of special about that. You know, I've already said it's a huge project. It's one of the, if not the largest, it's certainly one of the largest distributions with many thousands of packages. We work with companies. We're not a company. There is no company called Debian. There is no Debian legal existence, in fact. We're organized as a project of software in the public interest, but Debian per se is just a project. It's not a company. It's not even a nonprofit corporation, though it might be interesting to change that someday. But we work with lots of different companies to maintain and develop software. As you can tell by the shirt I'm wearing, I work for HP. At least that's where my paychecks come from at the moment. And it's very exciting to see HP and IBM and to some extent Sun and other companies participating in this project and donating hardware and contributing people's time to help make things work. And I think those companies get some benefit back from Debian in interesting ways, ranging from actually using the software for early product development and release cycles to, in some cases, I think just being pleased to help a large volunteer project that's a core part of the community. Debian's very focused on freedom. If you haven't caught on to that yet, if you hang around Debian for a while, you will. And I think we're very well represented in the free software world. This comes in many forms. There are many interesting people who are now part of the Debian project and participating as developers. But in the other direction, Debian participants are also very active in other activities around the community, ranging from working groups of the Free Standards group around the Linux standards base and so forth, to participation in OASIS, which is trying to, you know, come up with good standards for XML definitions, all sorts of interesting things. Promise to you a few statistics. Here they are. Debian 3.0 released on 11 architectures. Five of those are ones that I personally had some involvement in, either started that board or was instrumental early on in helping it to gain sort of critical momentum. So I feel a lot of sort of personal pride and ownership in the breadth of systems that Debian successfully runs on, but no matter how you count it, that's an awful lot of different kinds of hardware. There are some other ports in process. I talk about the Hitachi SuperH stuff. It's actually sort of a challenge because it's one of these processor families that is challenging to support in a distribution like Debian because almost every version of the processor chip that comes out has some performance issue with it that causes you to want to use different compiler options to get good performance out of it. And that's, of course, challenging if what you'd like to do is have one set of binaries that works across all the members of a family. We're thinking about that. There are other architectures where there's interest in trying to do performance-tuned binaries for specific flavors of the family, even if we're pretty strongly convinced that it's not a terribly useful thing to do right now for the Pentium sort of flavored systems. And then there's always the AMD Hammer stuff. Since I work for HP, I spend more time thinking and working with IA64. But we're all sort of intrigued to see what happens with the Hammer stuff. And there have been at least two, if not three, groups within Debian that have been trying to sort of get a port started there. I gather the real issue is still hardware availability and difficulty of people getting their hands on real machines to play with. Also, you know, one of the things that's caused us to grow a little bit beyond just being a Linux distribution is that the Free Software Foundation's HERD project chose Debian to be their packaging system and user space for the work they're doing with the HERD. And there's a very good chance, actually, that if not in Sarge, then in the release afterwards, that we may actually be able to release a HERD-based distribution. I'm not personally really sure how much use that will really get. But there's all sorts of interesting things that those guys are working on, and I like to see them being encouraged, and I like to see them using Debian and taking advantage of what's there. There are also a couple of projects running with people trying to figure out how to use BSD kernels with Debian user space. Again, we'll see sort of how that pans out over time, but they're enthusiastic and they've made lots of progress, and there's some good bits there if you're interested. I think the statistics that wow me the most every time I think about them, though, are the number of people and the number of software packages involved. We do package our software in a relatively finely grained fashion, but still, with over 1,100 people maintaining over 7,000 source packages, many of which produce multiple binary packages, you know, separating documentation or libraries from the resulting executables, we're getting very, very close to 12,000 binary packages in the unstable tree. This is a look at how that number of developers has grown over time. I don't know if you can read the axes on here very well, but the lower left corner, the end of the line, is late 1995, and it goes up through the 14th of January, which was the last day I was at home before I left. And you can see that it's amazingly linear over that time, except for this one big blip in the middle. And that big blip was when we closed the new maintainer process for several months to go figure out how to do it better. And when we turned it back on, what intrigues me is not only is that fairly linear, but the line is the same line across the gap. In other words, the top and bottom pieces pretty closely line up. That suggests to me that even during the time where we were telling people, nope, sorry, we don't know how to absorb you into the project, you know, go away and come back some other day, the level of interest in joining the Debian project and contributing to this activity remained high enough that when we came back, boom, it sort of popped back to the same line it had been on before. There are, of course, I suppose, other interpretations, but that's the one that makes me feel the best at night. And this is how those people are distributed. There are quite a few here in Australia, as you saw, there are quite a few here today. But the biggest concentrations are in North America and in Western Europe. It is spreading and growing, though, and as I said, I had the opportunity recently to speak in Veracruz, Mexico, signed some keys, answered some questions on tasks and skills for people who are at that point in the process of applying to be new maintainers, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this, you know, spread out and become a much more red-looking plot over time. This is the other graph that kind of gets my attention. This is the count of source packages over time. And if you look at that, it's on the same time scale, and you can see that, again, you know, it's sort of linear maybe, except that when you look at it a little bit harder, there's actually a little bit of a curve to it, and that's kind of frightening. There's one sort of slight backtick at the top, but my observation in the past when I've messed with this plot and updated it is that over time those little wiggles tend to work themselves out. And you know, I've commented to people a couple of times that at this rate, eventually all software developers will have packaged all software for Debian, and you'll all be working for Debian and using Debian whether you want to or not. I don't know if that'll really come to pass, but these are sort of impressive, and I'm intrigued over how many years now these things have stayed very close to linear. It is tempting to wonder what's limiting these processes when they look linear. Because in the natural world, things that look linear are sort of unusual. You don't really expect that. But regardless of what the answer to that is, these are fairly impressive growth rates. So let me talk a little bit about the history of the project. Out of curiosity, how many of you have been paying attention to Debian, using Debian, or working on Debian since, let's say, before 1998? Since that's the end of my thing here. Wow, I'm impressed. It's kind of unusual for me to stand up in front of a crowd and get that many people who will admit to that. let me talk a little bit about how things got started. Back in 1993, believe it or not, is when Debian 0.01 was released. At that time, there really weren't that many things that we would today call Linux distributions around. In fact, the original motivation on Ian Murdoch's part for working on Debian was this notion that what was out there really sort of wasn't done right yet, and it sure would be nice to have something that was easier to install and update and didn't require you to do, you know, sort of huge pieces of repetitious work. And very rapidly, when that initial stuff got done, and then in early 1994 when he put together this thing called the Debian Linux Manifesto, sort of modeled on Richard Stallman's GNU Manifesto, people started becoming attracted to the project and wanting to help and wanting to be involved. We were talking yesterday in the Q&A session about the fact that the bar has been raised some in recent times for becoming involved with interesting projects. Well, back then, this was a brand new project, and the bar wasn't very high. Certainly wasn't very high when I joined. they let me in. But I see this 0.91 release as being really significant because the Debian Linux Manifesto was a huge attractor for people who shared Ian's worldview, people who were more interested in software quality than timeliness, who were more interested in getting it right than getting it out. And a lot of people, you know, started to come in and be attracted to the project. This was also when the first version of the Debian package management stuff appeared. And that was sort of a concept that hadn't really been part of Linux distributions up until that time. By the time of the 0.91 release, there were about 12 people contributing. And Ian says that that was really the last one-man release. At that point, there were contributors and they were doing various things, but he still sort of was involved in wrapping things up and putting them out himself. By March of 1995, when the 0.93 series, you can see 0.01, 0.91's fairly big jump. Ian says, well, once we got a package manager and all that, it seemed like we were about done. So he's getting close to a 1.0 version. By March of 1995, there were enough people involved in the project that it became clear that some way to divide the responsibilities was important. And so this idea of an explicit package maintainer was invented. This is sort of an evolutionary step. Instead of a bunch of friends all sort of working together and putting this thing out, they sort of divvy things up, and this guy will worry about Emacs, and this guy will worry about VI, and this guy will worry about an editor that really works. And and at the end of the day, when that release came out, the really significant introduction was the replacement of the simple package manager with the first version of what we call DPKG, the Debian packaging tool. It sort of implements what I like to think of as the assembly language of package management. It's one of those tools that you find yourself using once in a while, but in general, you'd like to have something between you and it, sort of in the same way that when writing software, you'd much rather be playing around with a compiler than with an assembler most days. By late 1995, when 0.93R6 was released, there were up to about 60 contributors. It was somewhere in this time that I had become involved. I don't think I was actually, I'd have to go back and look, but I don't think anything that I packaged was part of 0.93R6, though it might have been. I don't really remember. It was certainly in the middle of 1995 that I got involved, after the time that 0.93R5 was put together. The other big thing that happened in 1995 was the introduction of dselect, which is still my favorite user interface to our packaging system. Well, you know, what can you say? When you started using it when it first came out and you can drive it with your eyes closed on a variety of architectures because you've done that so much, it's hard to walk away from. And it still is actually the easiest way to do certain things in the Debian packaging system, but I know I'm not going to convince any of you who came late to the party and, you know, don't know how to drive it by feel. By that point, there are about 60 contributors. And you know, that's pretty substantial growth from August of 93 to November of 95, going from nothing to about 60 seriously motivated people working on the project. The next big milestone was in the middle of 1997 when the Debian Social Contract was released. I'll show you some excerpts from that and talk about it a little bit more in a minute, but this is another major step in the evolution of the project. The first big attractor was the manifesto. And after a while, it became obvious that enough stuff was getting packaged and enough interesting things were being added to the distribution that at some point we were going to have to start making tough decisions about, is this piece of software something that belongs in the distribution or not? And that led to this whole discussion about what is free and what's not. And that led to this whole discussion about commitments to our users. And from that came the Debian Social Contract and the associated free software guidelines, which most people know these days out in the real world better by the sort of revised name as the open source definition. And then I point to July 1998 and the Debian 2.0 release as being sort of the last milestone of the early years because that was the first release that included an architecture other than I386. And it's sort of significant that it was M68K for a couple of reasons that are important to me and probably not to you. One of them is that much of the way our auto builder infrastructure is crafted and how those things work is driven by the fact that it was a very slow architecture that was being added to the project. And so there's lots and lots of code around to try and help make sure that auto builders don't build things they don't need to and all of that sort of stuff. And if you were only caring about modern, very fast processors, you might make some of those fundamental design decisions a little bit differently. So how did I find Debian? Well, I guess in the earliest sort of interaction I had with Debian was Bruce Perrin's fault. I was working for the Amateur Satellite Corporation on a payload for a satellite that's now called Oscar 40. We were really interested in understanding what the antenna radiation patterns of the GPS satellites were on the outside of the GPS constellation. And in fact, we've since discovered what the answer is. But at that time, we were designing a custom GPS receiver so that we could get around some of the technical limitations, and more importantly, the legal and political limitations of commercial GPS receivers in the early days of the GPS system. And this thing was based on an AMD 29200 processor. And well, we needed tools for it. And the GNU tools were a good choice. And I was using BSDI. Which, I don't know, how many of you know about BSDI? It was a commercialized version of the 386 BSD stuff early on. I don't even know if they're still around. I think it's all sort of merged with the free BSD universe in some way I don't completely understand. Brought up by Wind River, you're right. I don't completely understand. At that time, I was living in Colorado Springs. Rob Kolstad and Jeff Polk were also living in Colorado Springs, so therefore the BSDI headquarters was on the road between where I worked and where I lived. And so as one of their early users and beta testers, every time they snapped an internal version, I get a call from Jeff saying, want to stop by on the way home and pick up a tape? And I would. So I have this interesting collection at home of early versions of BSDI internal and public releases that are all serial number one, because he hadn't gotten to FedEx to ship the ones off to the other BSDI employees and distant places yet. And when I walked in, I just took the first one off the pile. So at that time, I was running BSDI, and I would go through this laborious process of figuring out how to get, you know, all the compiler, and we were using newlib and getting all these pieces to build. I'd generate this tarball of the results and put it out on the net and tell people it was there in the rest of this project and suggest they go pick it up and use the fresh version of the tools. Well, I discovered eventually that what they were doing was downloading this tarball, unpacking it, taking one file out of it, which was the notebook file where I had laboriously cut and pasted all the commands I had used to build this thing. They were replacing the BSD tags with Linux tags and regenerating it for Linux. And when I found out about this, I was kind of frustrated, because the whole point of my doing this, since I wasn't really writing a whole lot of the code for that thing, I was the toolmeister. So the whole point was, you know, I was trying to keep them from having to deal with all of this. And so simultaneously, Bruce had started talking about this project he was excited about called Linux for Hams, this idea that ham radio operators ought to be Linux users, and it might be easier if we did a version of Linux designed specifically for them. And the convergence of those two things just sort of caused a bell to go off in my head and say, you know, I've been hearing about this Linux thing for a while. Maybe it's gone beyond the toy stage. I should go take a look and find out what it's all about. And lo and behold, you know, I sent Bruce a message. I knew Bruce from amateur radio things prior to that. I said, so tell me, you know, what should I do to go check all of this out? And he told me about Debian, and I don't know, things went downhill from there. Bruce had gotten so involved in helping to make Debian work well so that he could use it as a base for Linux for Hams that he never actually got around to finishing the Linux for Hams project. But along the way, he sucked several of us into doing Debian things, and well, we're still there. I became a package maintainer fairly quickly. It's sort of how things work in Debian. You start using it, and you trip over the first thing that's not there that you expected to be there, and you go, I should fix that. And the next thing you know, in my case, Bruce sent a message to Ian Murdoch saying, hey, there's this guy, BDL. He's written a lot of software in the amateur radio world. Pretty well known, does all kinds of protocol things. He has a piece of software he wants to package up. What do you think? And the response from Ian was, hey, welcome to the project, BDL. It's a little different than our new maintainer process today. But initially, I contributed some amateur radio software. And then the person who's maintaining TAR and GZIP, went away, and I knew those were important, and somebody had to do a good job with them, so I picked them up, and I've picked up several dozen other things that way in the meantime. At some point, there was a real concern, because Debian, in its early days, was already well on the road to having all of its infrastructure be sort of begged, borrowed, and, well, never stolen, to the best of my knowledge. Not exactly, at least. There was a machine running under somebody's desk on a university campus that was ftp.debian.org at that time. And the individual in question was getting some pressure from the university about the amount of network traffic going to and from his cube. And there was some concern about whether all of a sudden he might be forced to shut this down or what would happen. Bruce knew that I worked at HP and that I managed a group that maintained a big chunk of technical computing infrastructure and had nice machine rooms and all this sort of stuff. And he sort of did the nudge, nudge, wink, wink, just in case something bad happens. Could you set a machine up and sort of, you know, copy, pull a copy of the archive over so we don't lose it if something happens? And I did that. And the next thing you knew, we had this machine on the air called master.debian.org. And it was sort of the shadow server in the background that developers would upload things to. This is the beginning of this structure where the archive got constructed on one machine and then got mirrored out to a set of publicly visible machines for other things to happen. And without HP having any real understanding of this, though, I guess I sort of had permission to make this decision. HP hosted master.debian.org in one of our data centers in Colorado Springs for about 16 months. Until we were getting ready for an internal audit and they were changing our internal network billing structure, and I knew I was going to have a hard time explaining that big bar on the Pareto. And then it sort of went away for a while. And it gives me great pleasure, actually. When I went back to work for HP in May of 2001, and I told my new boss this story, after he stopped laughing and saying, yeah, that's sort of how things work around here, isn't it? It's really exciting to me that HP is doing such a good job now of sort of supporting the Debian project above board. We've always been pretty good at supporting the project, and it's nice now to actually be able to, like, you know, wear the logo around and not have to skulk around about it. Then over time, as I said, I helped start the Alpha Spark and ARM ports, and more recently the PA RISC and I64 projects, both of which I'm still reasonably involved with. The PA RISC guys still let me hang around with them. I spend most of my time working on the IA64 stuff. And then when I was down here in Australia last year, I got a certain amount of arm twisting about considering running again for the Debian project leader position, which I did and got elected. And, well, here I am to talk to you again. This, by the way, is the processor board with the 29200 on it that caused me to find Debian. The nondescript little black chip in the lower left-hand corner is the 29200. The big, sexy-looking must-be-the-processor chip is actually a flow-through error detection and correction chip. That board runs really pretty fast for that era. Had a 60-nanosecond bus cycle, you know, single-cycle RISC. I wrote the boot ROM for this thing, which was 2K bytes of 29200 assembly language. It supported peek, poke, and execute over three separate interfaces and never touched RAM. Unless you told it to. In other words, you could sort of reset the processor, have it come up in the boot ROM, and be able to do a complete dump of RAM without affecting the contents of RAM. This is possible, of course, because that processor's got 192 32-bit registers. The problem is it's only got one that you can use as an index to point to the other, so if you actually want to use several buffers in the register file, it's kind of crazy keeping up with everything. But that was the last truly incredibly snarly, geeky piece of embedded software I wrote, and I'm still kind of proud of it. The reason that board didn't fly, by the way, well, there's several reasons, but one of them is that that meter on the right is measuring current, and that's 1.13 amps at 10 volts. So it's it cooks. So as long as I'm talking about AmpSat, let me do a little side trip here. I can't stand up and sort of have the podium for too long without talking about my other big passion a little bit, which is amateur satellites. And there's sort of a connection here, since it's what dragged me into Debian. AmpSat is the Amateur Satellite Corporation, and it's got branches all over the world, and we build amateur satellites in our basement. When I say amateur satellites, I really do mean communication and scientific satellites that go in orbit around the Earth, and maybe in 5 or 6 years we'll send one to Mars. Oscar 40, which is what I was working on at the time that I became involved with Debian, was the 40th amateur satellite to successfully achieve orbit. And it's mostly a communications platform, but it carried some science experiments, and those are the things that I'm personally sort of most interested in. It was launched in November of 2000 and was part of a really record-setting launch, by far the heaviest amateur satellite ever launched, on the largest launch that ever went. To give you some idea, that's the satellite on the rotisserie. And that's me with the silly little blue hat in the back left talking to our project manager. This was in French Guiana at the European Space Agency's launch facility in one of the integration buildings as we were performing final system checks prior to buttoning things up, putting the solar panels on, and putting it on the rocket. This is how all the stuff stacked together. AMSAT sort of sneaks things in underneath the primary payload and around the edges. That's us, the big thing in the bottom. I always love the fact that a piece of the mechanical structure that held up PAS-1R, which was Pan AMSAT's, it's now Pan AMSAT's flagship television relay satellite, covers most of North and South America and parts of Africa. I love the fact that, I don't know if you can see in that drawing, but there's a 400 Newton biprop thruster on our spacecraft aimed right up at them. And they're sitting on a piece of mechanical structure that we designed and built and delivered to Arianespace. So, kind of crazy stuff. And of course, you gotta have a nice rocket picture to make it seem like rocket science. It was a night launch, and it was covered on, Pan AMSAT, of course, being the primary payload, has lots and lots of TV transponder space up in Geospink, and so they did a live, unencrypted transmission of the launch, and it was really cool. I mean, my whole family sitting in the living room, my daughter jumping up and down at the end about Daddy's satellite getting into orbit. And anyway, let's come back to Debian. I talked a little bit about this idea that the Debian project has evolved over time. I got asked to do a dinner talk for the opening meeting of the Gelato Federation a while back. This is a group that's trying to bring together IA64 and Linux and various other bits and pieces for sort of the next generation high performance research computing platform with quite a bit of sponsorship from HP and other organizations. And what they asked me to do, because they were at that meeting going to be trying to establish their sort of mission and vision and direction and all for the organization, was they asked me to come do a talk about creating successful missions, how Debian had done it. And I had to scratch my head about this one a little bit, because I had always prior to that thought of Debian as being a much more haphazard and chaotic organization than that. But what I realized on thinking about it is that while it doesn't really match with the definition of the word mission, because missions are all about sending people, you know, sending out missionaries or your mission should you choose to accept it and all of this, that in Debian, they're actually sort of this evolution of the set of attractors that cause people to want to come and be involved in the project. That began with the manifesto, sort of evolved through the time period where Bruce Perens was thinking of Debian as a base that other people might build on someday. There are even discussions with various commercial distributors about, gee, why don't you just use Debian as your base and, you know, go build your value-added on top of that. We're way ahead of our time. The United Linux stuff sounded really familiar to me when they started talking about it more recently. Then there was this period of time I call holders of the higher ground. There was a period of time where the thing that seemed to be drawing people into Debian was the fact that we were holding various things to higher standards. Either we weren't going to release yet because something wasn't right technically, or we were going to push bind out of the distribution because they included a crypto library that didn't meet the Debian free software guidelines, or in one way or another, people started giving us respect because we weren't going to sort of bend our fundamental principles just to, you know, take advantage of some short-term possibility. And then the really big thing that happened was the introduction of another layer of technology in our packaging system, the apt-get mechanism. And as I think as any of you that are Debian users are aware, there's something that's just sort of, even today, there's something that's a little magical about just sitting at your machine and, you know, running an apt-cache or an apt-search or an apt-get and having great gobs of software come flying into your machine from all over the place that actually seems to work when it gets there most of the time. And this really brought about a sort of an inflection point in the curve of the number of users of Debian, where all of a sudden it got easier and there was this big, gee, that works better than other approaches at this moment thing that happened. And all of a sudden Debian went from being this sort of geeky thing that everybody respected intellectually but didn't necessarily want to run to something that people really did want to use. And then I point to the new maintainer processing and the new maintainer process, which doesn't seem so new anymore, as being another big step along the way, because that was the time when we started to really sort of explicitly filter the people who came to be part of Debian to make sure that they did sort of understand what this was all about and agree with the fundamental principles and ideals that we were trying to achieve. I think the manifesto is sort of instructive to go back and look at. I've extracted four little excerpts from it, and I think they still today give a reasonably good general sense of what this Debian thing's supposed to be all about. It's this idea of a Linux distribution developed openly in the spirit of Linux and GNU. Pretty much everything about Debian is sort of open, and all the dirty laundry hangs out there on the mailing lists. And if you want to understand what's going on in Debian, all you got to do is read a lot. There's very little out there that you can't get your hands on fairly quickly if you're curious and interested and have a high tolerance for pain. It's going to be carefully and conscientiously put together, and will be maintained and supported with similar care. I still think that's very true. Of course, with over 1,100 people contributing packages and over 11,000 binary packages, there's clearly some variability in how successfully that seems to be going on any given day. And yet, I'm still very impressed with the fact that in the vast majority of cases, even when running our unstable tree, that I can just install things and expect them to work. And that wouldn't happen if people weren't remaining very careful and conscientious about how they put things together. I talked about the openness. The design process is open to ensure that the quality stays high and that it reflects the needs of the user community. There really isn't anything hidden here. The bug tracking system hangs out in the wind and so forth. It's not a, this last one actually causes you to stop and think a little bit, and it's one of the places where I am tempted sometime to go ask Ian Murdoch if he would still say this today now that he's running Progeny Linux systems. But that Linux is not a commercial product, and it never should be, but that this didn't mean that Linux would never be able to compete commercially. And I think, in fact, that we've sort of seen that happen to some extent. The few places where people have really tried to sort of take Linux and do something un-Linux-ish with it from a product standpoint have met mixed results. And the people that have been really successful have been the people that sort of figured out how this community works and figured out how to work with the community instead of trying to drag the community off in some strange direction. The social contract, I assume most of you are at least somewhat familiar with this. This is the commitment that the Debian project makes to our users. It was at the time that it was created, at least in my experience, a completely novel concept that you would have a social contract with your users and in effect would promise that you were never going to, you know, change the way that you interacted with them and go off and do something really strangely different. The thing that was really significant about the social contract, though, is that that first statement that will remain 100% free software forced us to have to define what free meant, which led to the Debian free software guidelines, which I suspect all of you have tripped over at least once in your travels in this community. These did get picked up and used initially, absolutely sort of carbon copied as the open source definition. There's actually some tension right now between the people who are maintaining the open source definition and the Debian project over the fact that there are some ambiguities in the text. And I'm personally one of those people who's willing to tolerate a little ambiguity on behalf of having stability of definitions. But there are people who feel very differently about that and would very much like to see these documents evolve. I don't know, you know, living in the United States, we've managed to go well over 200 years now without feeling the need to fundamentally revise some of the basic documents on which our government and social infrastructure are based. We have processes for amending the pieces that really ought to be amended, but it scares me a little bit to think about taking some of the very fundamental things that we all sort of used as attractors to the project and ways of sort of agreeing on what our shared values are and mucking with them. The bug tracking system and the policy manual are part of how all of this stuff works. Since 1994, Debian has had a bug tracking system that was completely visible to the world. Used mostly email in and web interfaces out. What's the bug number up to now? It's 100 and, do you know, AJ, 170 some thousand? Maybe 180 now, it's getting close. Over that period of time, we have tracked more than 170,000 defects in packages that were part of the distribution. the number of those that remain open is also one of those things that, should I plot it, would look sort of frighteningly linear. However, I point out to people when I'm asked that if that curve stays more or less linear and the developer count and the package count are also kind of linear, I'm just glad it's not, you know, horribly worse. It suggests to me that that attention and the care and the conscientiousness is still there. There's just an awful lot of software and an awful lot of things that can have to be dealt with. We've also ended up using our bug tracking system as is sort of a, I hesitate to call it a to-do list manager, but that really is sort of what it is. There are times when we make policy changes because we've discovered that there's some better way to do something, and we'll end up filing bugs against all the packages that need to be updated to reflect this policy change. So not all of those are sort of hideous defects that the stuff doesn't work today, but there really have been a it really has been a huge use of that system for keeping track of things that we're working on. And I think the policy documents in Debian are a key part of why the packaging system works so well. It's one thing to have a good packaging tool set and to have the technical ability to do things like provide strong dependency specifications, but if you don't have policies that say that packages ought to use these things and people committed to following those policies and tools that help you to craft things correctly without having to think about it all the time, like things that automatically discover shared library dependencies and all of those bits and pieces, it's hard for those pieces of technology to actually be used to the greatest advantage. And I'm really tickled that the combination of policy and technology that we have in Debian seems to work as well as it does. We have this constitution too. This was sort of the next step in the evolution. The manifesto attracted people. The social contract sort of established the rules for how the project would interact with our users and the commitments that we would make. And as the project continued to grow and more people became involved, the constitution was created to sort of articulate the processes by which we would agree to go duke it out in the ring and not just kill each other in the streets when there were disagreements. The constitution really only covers the mechanisms by which disputes in the project will be resolved or that various other things that might need a vote will get handled. It really doesn't talk about much else beyond that. But one of the things that the Constitution sort of instantiated was a division of powers within the project that I think is sort of interesting, because the Constitution vests the vast majority of the power in the project with individual developers. And it sort of starts off saying, you know, it's from the developers and their work that all of the goodness in this project comes. Every once in a while, there can be situations where developers disagree with each other on something technical or otherwise and need someone to arbitrate that dispute. And the Constitution describes a technical committee made up of, you know, key technical contributors within the project to help mediate those disputes and come up with answers. And we, within the last year, have actually had one of those amazing events where, for the first time ever that I'm aware of, the technical committee chose to override a decision made by a maintainer and ask that maintainer to implement a feature in a package that they didn't want to do by themselves. And I think, in general, everybody feels that that was a functional process and the right result was achieved. But again, a sort of major milestone in the history of the project is it was the first time that we didn't just sort of discuss things endlessly and somebody cave at the end of the conversation. There's a project secretary that's articulated in the Constitution. Their principal job is to operate the mechanics of this voting process. There really isn't a whole lot else that's expected of the secretary. There's a project leader that's articulated, and that's the role that I currently have, the principal purpose of which is to act as the representative of Debian in various places, to go speak on behalf of the project, to engage in interactions with other organizations. The project leader has the authority to delegate responsibilities within the project, but precious little sort of direct ability to do anything without the support of the development community or the technical committee or, you know, the rest of the project. And then there are the delegates. There are certain key infrastructure processes. There are certain key relationships with other organizations where it makes sense to have one or more people specifically indicated as being responsible for those. And the project leader is responsible for creating those delegates. a bunch of communications tools used in the project that are part of how we make it work. I think the most significant pieces really are the fairly extensive use of IRC by the Debian development and using communities. When I go talk to people who aren't sort of immediately familiar with Debian or with the Linux community, they find it sort of intriguing that we're successful with a project that's as geographically distributed as ours is. And I think this really intense use of internet communications technologies is part of what makes that possible. We're sort of proud in a strange sort of way of how itty-bitty the machine is that runs the Debian mailing list server. And we manage to transit a really intense number of messages every day with really good latencies. The rest of this I think we've already talked about some. The auto building system is another key component of how things are able to work in Debian. It's how we manage to keep that many packages built from one set of source packages for all of those architectures. I talked about this to a fairly great extent yesterday during the talk that I gave on porting, so I won't belabor a lot of this now. There is something that's worth spending a minute or two on, because even if you use Debian, you may not quite have figured out this whole how packages get promoted through the various distributions thing. All new package uploads, whether it's a completely new package or a new version of an existing package, gets uploaded into this tree that we call unstable. And since we're still using names that are derived from Toy Story characters, the unstable tree is named for Sid, you know, that kid next door who should never be let out of the house. It also, you know, there are various other definitions, but every time I think of that guy with, you know, the M80 tied to the back of the, never mind. By definition, unstable gets unstable sometimes, but there are an awful lot of people who use it. How many of you are actually running unstable? you know, Dan Shearer commented yesterday that you knew you were at a Linux conference when you walked in and somebody loaned you their laptop to do a presentation and asked you to please be careful because it was their stable production, you know, software development platform, and it turns out it was running 2.5.50. I feel that way every time I stand in the middle of a crowd of Debian people and ask this question about unstable. Well, you know, my laptop's running unstable too, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But the whole idea of this promotion towards release process is that, by definition, something new that's been uploaded is unstable. We don't know anything about it. We don't know whether to trust that version of that package is good or not. And so we have this, you know, set of promotion rules that start out with the idea that a package ought to sit for a little while and accumulate bugs from the users of unstable before it's allowed to propagate forward. In other words, it has to sort of establish itself as being stable. If it gets uploaded and the assumption is that somebody somewhere is probably using it, maybe lots of somebodies if it's something like glibc, that will discover the vast majority of the hideous bugs before it gets promoted into, you know, some sense of a higher level of stability. If the package sort of survives this hazing period and enough people in unstable seem to be using it, though we don't actually have any real way to measure that, and it hasn't accumulated more bugs and all of its dependencies are met, it's allowed to promote forward into this distribution we call testing. And the idea behind this is that it's a rolling release candidate. If we really wanted to, on any day, that release ought to be something that we could pick up and press on CDs and would just work. It isn't always quite that simple, of course, but the idea is that there shouldn't be any structural failings in that distribution, that all the things that you can mechanically check about package goodness should have happened by the time packages get there. And then sort of in parallel with all of that, there's the security process for dealing with security alerts and getting security updates to packages out fairly quickly, even though there's some inertia in the process for normal package uploads. Then I think when things are working well, the idea is that we do a major release every 12, maybe as much as 24 months. Woody was one of the longer release cycles that we've had, but it's because we sort of turned the entire infrastructure universe upside down, implemented a whole new way of handling this package promotion and formation of a stable distribution, handled the transition of cryptographic software back into the US mirrors, and all sorts of other things that I think everyone that was involved hopes are once in a lifetime occurrences. And then we've been trying really hard to do a point release that sort of rolls in all of the security fixes since the last major release on sort of an every other month kind of basis. The first one for Woody was fairly substantially delayed, in part because of the fire at the University of Twente in the Netherlands that took out a couple of important Debian servers, the non-US and security servers, but in part just because it was the holiday season and things were strange too. So what can you do if you want to help? Lots of you are using Debian, some of you are developers. From the question I asked earlier, I know lots of you want to help Debian. The first thing is just use it. And by using it, I don't just mean running the software. I mean, you know, reporting the bugs that you find. And if you're motivated and savvy about it, you know, try and help figure out what's wrong. You've got the source code to everything. You can hop on the IRC channels and ask questions if you're confused about something. If you have a particular problem that's plaguing you, you know, help us figure out how to fix it. You don't have to be a Debian developer to do that. In fact, some of the most valuable people around the project are the people who submit bug reports along with the patches suggesting how to fix them. Really makes my day when I get a nice patch in my inbox in the morning. Unfortunately, I haven't had many of those the last couple of days. I've mostly had funny things about penguin drink shakers, but there are areas that perennially need help. It would be marvelous to have more people working on documentation. I had a conversation with Rasmus at the conference in Veracruz that he and I both attended, and I'm really impressed with the number of people around the PHP project, but I'm even more impressed with the immense fraction of them that are quote-unquote only working on documentation. You know, there are a lot of people working on documentation things around Debian too, but because so many of them are involved in things like handling translations to other languages and so forth, I'm never really sure on any given day how much sort of new good documentation is really being generated. There are even packages that, you know, have sort of tediously poor man pages that exist mostly to satisfy the requirement that there be a man page for the binary. I know I'm guilty of that. And so, you know, don't be ashamed to look around, and if there's something that disappoints you a little bit, see if you can offer some sort of a contribution to help the project out. We greatly appreciate it. And if you really are capable, committed, and you want to maintain packages, then you certainly are free to apply to become a Debian developer. The bar is higher than it used to be. It won't just be an email from Bruce Perrins, Ian Murdoch, and a pleasant reply. But it is quite possible. The process sort of starts out by making initial contact with our new maintainer process, and then there's an identification phase where we try to match up some real-world identification credentials with your online persona. Those of you that have participated in key signing activities here have a leg up on that already, because you'll be absolutely guaranteed to have one or more Debian developers sign your key before the end of the week. There's then a process where we actually make sure that you understand some of the philosophy and procedures that are core to how the project works. This involves things like going and reading the social contract and agreeing to abide by it. There's a task and skills check. That sort of is tailored based on what it is that you say you're interested in and what you'd like to do in the project. We unfortunately have had some people try to join the project in the past who philosophically were 100% in agreement with what we wanted to do and were just utterly incapable of packaging a piece of software and uploading it safely. And so we put in this sort of task and skills check. It's sort of amusing because there are some high profile new maintainer candidates who have sort of stalled out at tasks and skills. And I think it's mostly because they get to that point and they realize, oh, I really have to do all of this stuff if I'm going to upload a package to Debian, and I'd rather go write more good software and let somebody else package it and deal with it. And as I was commenting to someone yesterday afternoon, there are only maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10% of the Debian packages where the upstream maintainer and the Debian package maintainer are the same person. And that doesn't actually surprise me, because I think the skills involved in creating good new software and the skills involved in packaging software and making it really useful for other people are not always skills that are found in the same person. So in conclusion, I think the Debian project helps to demonstrate that the core values that are associated with free software are core values that are really attractive to lots of people. They have certainly brought the Debian project an immense amount of support. which ranges all the way from the number of you that seem to use it and hopefully like it, to the number of people that are involved in the project, the fact that all of the hardware that Debian is currently using for all of the Debian.org servers and many of the development systems is donated hardware, all of the bandwidth consumed by the Debian project, and boy, it's a lot of bandwidth, is donated bandwidth. I'm led to believe that in the United States, a tier one mirror these days isn't worth installing unless it can have at least 45 megabits worth of network connection. And there are, I don't know, 6 or 8 servers in the US now. It's a fairly intense amount of traffic load. I'm led to believe, I don't know, Michael, do you know the number anymore? I think it's 380, yeah, it's, we've got something like 380 published mirrors now. It's, huh? 270 for Maine, right, because that doesn't count the next level. It's a ridiculously huge number, no matter how you count on it. There were a couple of good talks earlier in the week at the Debian Mini Conference. If you caught them, great. If not, gee, sorry. They talked about how to cache things instead of mirror it and all sorts of other interesting tricks for keeping the bandwidth in your local area from being ridiculous. But it's just amazing to me how much support the project has. You know, if you were a company, if you were a .com and you went out to try and buy the bandwidth resources to do something like this, you'd be broke even faster than most of the .coms were. It just sort of amazes me how willing and able people are to donate resources to this project. Debian is clearly one of the most successful volunteer projects ever. There are over 1,000 volunteers around the world sitting up late at night, you know, making things work and making the world safe for bits. And that just continues to boggle me. That, by the way, when people ask me what I do for a living, that's sort of my stock answer these days. I make the world safe for bits. I'm not sure what it means either, but it sounds cool. All of the infrastructure and communications tools that Debian uses are 100% open source. They're not all 100% packaged in Debian, but they're all available one way or another. And we encourage people to, you know, take advantage of this and use this stuff. If you've got other projects where some of the technology that we're using would be helpful, please go for it. And at the end of the day, you know, Debian GNU Linux, it really is a universal operating system, or it's certainly on its way to being that. More architectures, more packages, more people, more places than almost anything else I've ever had the personal experience of running into. And, you know, hopefully we'll do a good job of stewardship of this, and it'll be a good place for the next generation to hang out and do their computing as well. These are my kids. That's my daughter, Elizabeth. She's the one who installed did most of the installation of raft.debian.org. She's 10 now. And she's a more rabid Debian advocate than almost anyone I know. And it's my son Robert's 4. His favorite thing about Linux is Blue Mango Quest, but we won't go there. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them. For more information, please go take a look at www.debian.org. And the URL at the bottom of the screen is where this and all of my other talks eventually go to die. Thank you very much.